This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the TLS podcast. With the summer holidays upon us, now seems a good time to take stock and revisit some memorable moments from a year's worth of podcasts. This week, we discuss the continued cultural impact of one of the world's greatest crime writers, Agatha Christie. And as the Booker Long list for 2021 has been announced, the author Edmund Gordon reviews one of this year's nominees, Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. But let's start with someone who has not only been nominated for a Booker Prize, but who last autumn won it. In the week following the announcement, our own Toby Lichtig was joined by Douglas Stewart to talk about his hard-hitting and yet somehow funny novel, Shuggy Bane.
Shuggy Bane. Firstly, I'm sorry about my pronunciation. I'm not going to try and do a Glaswegian accent, but if I say Shuggy, is that okay?
That's pretty good.
Okay. I'm just going to say Shuggy, but with my sort of flat London brogue or whatever it is that I've got. Shuggy Bane has been described by you as a Thomas Hardy novel set in Glasgow. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know if it's a Thomas Hardy novel as much as one of the biggest influences on my writing has certainly been Thomas Hardy. I wanted to look at something that swept across Glasgow. It's a love story between mother and son as they're struggling to survive in 1980s Glasgow as the city is sinking into 26% unemployment all around them. But Agnes Bane, who is the mother of the family, is a bright, beautiful, proud, generous mother. But after she's cruelly abandoned by her husband, she begins to descend into addiction and alcoholism. And it's her youngest son, Shuggy, who stays by her side the longest and loves his mother and tries to save her from her fate. And I think it's that question of fate and doom, and also how in Hardy's work, Tess is sort of formed and passed and used by the things that happen to her. Agnes almost is too. She's kind of tossed around in the winds of the time, and it sort of echoes some of what I feel about Tess.
Yeah, so these marginal figures, aren't they, who are central to your narrative, and Shuggy himself feels quite sort of different and other and marginal within his own community. And I guess Agnes as a woman is marginalised in this very patriarchal society, but also because of her own struggles to kind of keep her life in order, she is also on the kind of periphery of things.
That's right. I mean, here's a mother, like many mothers in the 80s, who had so much ambition and dreams and wants, and society would give her nowhere to put them as a working class woman. And so at the first half of the book, we almost see her as being too much. She's seen by the character around her as being too much, almost exhausting. But actually, she's not too much. It's just the world around her is not enough. And Shuggy as well, as you say, is dealing with his own sort of form of isolation, because he's very quickly deemed no right by the people around him, which is a very Glaswegian blunt way of saying, what's wrong with you? Why are you like this? But he is an effeminate little boy. He's precocious because his entire universe is his mother. So he's around, you know, he learns everything through her. And he's othered very quickly by the boys and the men around him.
And you talk about fate. I mean, it's interesting because although we follow Shuggy through his childhood into his early adolescence in this novel, there's actually a prologue, isn't there? A short prologue in the beginning in which we see the teenage Shuggy. Obviously, something's gone badly wrong. He's living alone in a bedsit. He's being taken advantage of by his boss, a delicatessen, and he's being sort of perved on by this creepy fellow guest. And he's very much, you can see, he's a victim. But already at this stage, you can see this resilience. It's a kind of polite resilience, but it's definitely a resilience. And I just wonder to what extent you think this is a novel about surviving.
I think it's absolutely a novel about surviving. And actually, Shuggy, opening with the question of Shuggy and his own fate, I wanted to frame then Agnes's choices and what she does throughout the book. And all of the things that Agnes does and Shuggy does, and even halfway through the book, we see that Agnes's mother had to make some very difficult choices about surviving, is really looking at when the chips are down or when things are hard, people do what they can to get by. And there's a dignity in that, although sometimes it's difficult to look at or maybe to process if you've never been in that situation yourself. None of us know what we would do until we're sort of faced with the headwinds or the troubles that the Bain family face. But I also wanted to show Shuggy in that situation, because then I hoped it increased his compassion for his mother as we watch her go through her journey throughout the book. Because I think the big one, hopefully one of the themes in the book, is empathy as well, and how the characters relate to each other. Hope is central to the book, but it's not always a big sort of shining horizon or a big, sometimes in literature, it's a very glowing thing in the far distance. And I think that hope for many people who are maybe struggling or having a tough time is just the ability to get up every single day and face another day and get up again the next day and face another day and keep going. That is a hope. It's a small glimmer of hope, but it's a very powerful thing.
You absolutely see that in the character of Agnes, who, you know, however bad she is and in whatever bad state she got in the night before, she will get up, she will apply her lipstick, won't she? She'll get dressed and she'll, you know, exit her house looking like the best dressed woman in the, you know, in the community. As you say, those kind of the hope and dignity is really central to this. There's also the idea of escape, isn't there? So I mean, Agnes herself, she wants to better herself. That's how she ends up on the scheme, which kind of happens about 100 pages into the novel, I guess. And then you've got she's got three children. Obviously it's primarily about the relationship between her and her youngest, Shuggy, but you've got her oldest daughter Catherine and the middle child Leek, and they both try to get away. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that sort of the desire to escape and transcend in the book.
Absolutely. At the beginning of the book, we see Agnes and her husband and their three children living with Agnes's mother and father in a high-rise tower block in the middle of the city, which at the very beginning of the 60s seemed like the cure to all the city's ills. And we now know that these were very hastily made and they've since been torn down. It was an actual real tower block called Sight Hill. But Agnes longs for a front door of her own. She wants a garden for the kids to play in. You know, it's still a council house, but she just wants a home of her own that she can be incredibly proud of. And her husband uses that opportunity to move her to this house, but also then to essentially maroon her or leave her. Because he says in the book, she is such a beautiful, precious, rare thing. He couldn't bear the idea of someone else coming along into her life and mending the pieces and being with his wife. And so it serves his ego. He's a very cruel man in that way. But
doesn't he say something along the lines of he just wanted to see if she would do it, and you know, and having tested her and found that she came with him, that was enough, and he could sort of then abandon her. Is that right?
That's right. And I think there's echoes of that in society today. I think that's why people ghost people they're dating, and it serves your ego a lot to know that someone's pining for you and can't get over you. It takes a big man to say, you know, this relationship is finished, and shake your hand and leave the door. And Shug is not a big man in the book. And so he does cruelly abandon Agnes and their children on the back of also puncturing all of her hopes. But I've always known addiction to be a thing that not only affects the person who is suffering from it, but it has a scorching effect on the family and the community around the person. And as you say, the three children are orbiting. They love their mother deeply, but they're sort of orbiting her as though she's this brightest star that then starts to collapse in on herself like a black hole. And they all have to face the choice of how far will you go to save the person you love the most before you have to save yourself. And Shuggy, as the youngest, is the one that's left not only with his mother, but also with the choices of his siblings.
I mean, that relationship is so affecting, obviously, particularly the relationship between Shuggy and his mother. And I was very struck by a comment sort of towards the end of the book when Leek, his brother, almost advises him to get out while he can. And I think Shuggy just doesn't want to and can't for all the obvious reasons. You've spoken and you've been asked, I know, a great deal about your own relationship with your mother, who you mention in the acknowledgements, and you talk about her alcohol addiction. I'm not going to ask you kind of naff questions about to what extent you are Shuggy and to what extent Agnes is your mother, but I just wanted to talk a bit about the kind of the general cast and the general array of characters and to what extent they are the kind of people of your childhood and upbringing.
Well, it's certainly a work of fiction, but I did grow up as the queer son of a single mother. And my mum, was a really ambitious, beautiful woman, and I loved her very dearly, but she couldn't realise her dreams, and it sort of manifested into a deep hurt inside her, I think. And so alcohol was always a feature of my childhood, from my earliest memories up until my mother lost her struggle with it when I was about 16. And so although the book is not based on my mother, it's based on my love for my mother and the feelings of how children have hope and an unconditional love for parents who are flawed. But it's also just a look. I understand addiction. I understand poverty, having grown up on government benefits. I understand misogyny and homophobia because of the time and the place I grew up in. And so I wanted to bring those experiences as themes to the book. All the characters are fictitious in the book, but they're composites of real Glaswegians. One of the biggest compliments I get ever when someone from home reads the book and he says, "Oh, I know a Jinty," or "I know a Leek," and that's when you know you've sort of made characters that feel very real to people. And part of the reason why the book took 10 years to write was because I was busy sort of making a living elsewhere, but also because I love spending time with the characters and thinking about them and growing with them as a writer and really sort of trying to make them feel alive on the page. And I hope I've done that.
You've certainly done that. And I was going to mention, is it Jinty McClinchy?
Jinty McClinchy.
Wonderful, because she's always sort of popping around for a wee drink and then sort of vaguely robbing her friend or just trying
terror.
To.
She's a terror, Toby.
She's a terror. She is, but I mean, you know, actually, you know, on the surface, it's awful. Of course, it is, and Agnes is descending deeper and deeper into this very severe illness, and Jinty is an enabler. But those bits they're funny. I mean, they're really funny. And there's that, you know, that tremendously amusing line about an awful thing where Agnes is raped and Jinty describes her as having been a wee bit unlucky in love last night, I think was the line, which is, you know, I mean, the kind of morbid humour that courses through this is absolutely wonderfully realised. And yeah, I think, I can imagine Glaswegians, you know, reading it and if, you know, if they are seeing little bits of their world in there, I guess that must be tremendously gratifying to you. I wonder to what extent you found this reception different in the UK and the US. Do you find that whether reviewers or even friends and other people you know have read it, have they kind of taken it slightly differently, or is that not really the case at all?
Yeah, it's been a different experience all over, actually. It was first, although I'm Glaswegian, I've lived in New York for a wee while now, so the book was first published in America in February and published 2 weeks before the pandemic, so all these high hopes, and then it was sort of swallowed. But what was refreshing about telling a Scottish story in America is critics and readers take the book on its successes or its failures and take it as a thing that stands alone. And suddenly when it came back to the UK, you can't help but intersect with conversations about class and history and myself and who I am and all of these other things. And so it's just been even fascinating to contextualize it in that way. But
has it been harder in a way, do you think, to sort of contextualize it in that way? Was it kind of easier for you to kind of be taken at face value, as it were, when it was just American readers reading it? Or is that not really the case for you?
It's been incredibly difficult, yeah, to be honest with you, Toby, because people can't help but bring their own baggage and their own notions to it. And the class system in the UK is really a thing. And part of moving to America was sort of freeing myself from that, you know, yes, having grown up working class and poor. I felt limits and I felt exclusions and I felt that there were rooms I wasn't allowed in and rooms I was. And America has been freeing in that way. And so to bring this story home and to be met with that has been startling. I didn't realize I was unprepared, I suppose. I've been unprepared for a lot of things, but that was one of them.
It took 10 years to write. And, you know, despite everything in the novel, the poverty, the addiction, the desperation, the sense of this community having been hollowed out and abandoned by Thatcher, it's not an angry novel. I don't think anyone could classify it as an angry novel. And this may be a difficult question to answer, but was it ever an angry novel? Did you ever kind of feel as you were approaching it and starting it that you kind of needed to work off some anger, or did the sort of tone just fall naturally into place?
No, because I don't feel angry about the time. I feel sad, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I feel a huge amount of loss. I grieve for all the people who weren't supported enough to reach their potential or have the greatest lives they could. We know that unemployment was so high in the city. We know that drink and drugs and addiction swept in, and that life expectancy is 14 years lower still today for many in Glasgow than it is for many in London. And so we know that there's that gulf, and that doesn't make me angry. That just makes me incredibly sad. And then through the loss of my own mother, I feel nothing. That's almost been 30 years now, Toby. And I feel nothing but love and a desire to sort of memorialize her and all the formidable, strong, exhausting, terrifying women that surrounded her as well. You know, all these very complex characters. And so I just came at that. But also I think because I come from outside of traditional publishing circles, I didn't come up through a creative writing workshop or an MFA, as they call it in America. I wrote the book for myself in a lot of ways, and I wrote it in isolation. And so it allowed me only to focus on what the characters needed and not what readers expected. And that was a good place to be, because it allowed me to be brave. It allowed me to have no expectations of the work. And it also allowed me to hopefully show things with really a clear gaze, which I think, I hope, lends a dignity to the situation, even when the scenes are difficult or tough or horrible to look at.
Absolutely. Dignity is one of the central qualities of this novel. And it's not just Agnes either. I mean, you can just feel it kind of coursing through the book. I wonder how, so, you know, you were writing it for yourself. How did the kind of first break happen? I mean, I gather you sent it off to a few agents and, you know, it wasn't immediately accepted. Where did you get your first literary break?
Well, actually, I can give you a real scoop, Toby, and tell you an anecdote from the background I haven't told anyone. Probably about 2017, after working on it for 10 years, I went to a Christmas party in New York, and we were all sort of, you know, everyone's just celebrating. And I met a woman at the party, and she said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I work in fashion." I said, "What do you do?" And she says, "I work in publishing. She said, "I just lost my job. I was an editor and I was fired." And I said, "I've written a book." And that's the worst thing anybody at a party or that works in publishing wants to hear. And she just looked cornered. And I was so enthusiastic. And this poor person, who is gone on to be a wonderful agent called Tina Pullman, was just terrified. And so after sort of spending some time and realizing I wasn't a lunatic, she said, "I'll read your book, and if you want, and I'll give you some feedback. It will take me 6 months." And I handed her the manuscript after 10 years, and this was some days later. She called me about 4 hours later, and she said, you have a finished novel. And I was only looking for feedback around that. I was loving the writing of it so much, I wanted perspective so that I could write some more. That was what it meant to me. And she said, no, you're finished.
Was that disappointing in some way? Were you...
In a way, because I write for the love of the craft of it. And so in a way, I was looking for just to make this even richer than hopefully it was. But from there, I did what any debut novelist does. I queried. Tina gave me some confidence. She gave me some encouragement. And then I queried agents, was rejected by a bunch of agents. And then when I finally landed with a wonderful agent, she sent the manuscript out. And it was rejected. She told me it was rejected 20 times in America. But actually, it turns out it was rejected 32 times.
She's just trying to save you.
She was just saving me. She was saving. She never lost faith, but I think perhaps I was wilting.
Extraordinarily, you are only the second Scot to win the Booker, which just seems weird. And I just don't really get it. But your predecessor, James Kelman, has been a big influence on you as well. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about influence generally. You've mentioned Hardy. Kelman helped you to, I don't know, have a voice, but gave you a sense that you know, the Scottish voice, there was a place for it in literary culture.
Yeah, I always like to start with a little sort of footnote and say, Kelman and myself are not the only two Scottish writers. There's urgent, wonderful, terrific Scottish writing every single day, and I'm a huge fan of Graham Armstrong, Kirsten Innes, and Jenny Fagan, particularly as contemporary writers. But when I was a kid growing up, you know, the curriculum gave us the classics, which were a lot of, you know, middle-class English writers. And it was only when I got into my 20s that I was able to sort of turn around and seek out for myself queer voices, but also Scottish voices. And that's when I discovered writers like Kelman, Agnes Owens, George Friel, the wonderful Alan Warner. And that, for me, blew books open. It wasn't that I only read Scottish writing, but it's that it's important for all of us, no matter who you are, to have to read to travel and see other worlds and places you don't see. But we also always need to see representation of ourselves on the page. And so Kelman was one of my first influences, and How Late It Was, How Late is a remarkable book. I mean, it's a stream of consciousness about a Glaswegian alcoholic that wakes up blind in a prison cell and then spends the rest of this really chaotic weekend both navigating his new disability and getting around the city. It's an incredibly brave book. It's propulsive. It's violent, but it's also incredibly wonderful. And so it's been a huge influence on me.
Another thing you said in relation to the setting of your novel is that there's a danger of, well, maybe not a danger, but there could be a problem of poverty safari, you know, of middle-class readers coming to your world for a good gawp before returning to their smashed avocado or whatever it is they're returning to. But, and I was thinking about that because it's really interesting. But then I was thinking, in a sense, all reading is a safari of some kind or another, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we want to blur the lines between us and other people and all the rest of it, but we're always, to some extent, looking in. And I just wonder what you hope readers will take away from Shuggie Bain and the kind of the view of that Glasgow that they get.
You're right that all reading is a safari. And it doesn't, the idea of a poverty safari isn't the fault of a reader. It's a thing we're conditioned in society. When you grow up maybe poor, or there's trouble at home, or there's things that are less seemly, you're told to keep it at home. And even within working class communities, if you share it and if you tell people even on your street about it, they're like, why are you telling people? You know, it's rooted in shame. It's rooted in shame. And so I hope, when I wrote the book, I wanted it to be as immersive as possible, because I thought, if I am going to share this story with people who come from a different background, then I want them to be in the room with Agnes and Shuggie and to feel it fully, to hear it, to smell it, to touch it, and to really take the characters as much as any reader can as a care and a concern of their own, rather than just being able to be guided through it by an author who scoots you through it and sends you out the other end back to your own life.
To come, Robots and Murder, as we look back at the career of Agatha Christie and review the latest novel by Kazuo Ishiguro. And if you like what you've heard so far, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss an episode.
There's accounts of, you know, Owen possibly going around the East End of London and cruising, and Shadwell Stairs is his experience of that. Owen writes, "I walk till the stars of London wane and dawn creeps up the Shadwell Stair, but when the crowing sirens blare, I, with another ghost, am lain." And so when you read this as a cruising poem, you actually understand it as being a quite radical, unexpected poem about Owen's promiscuity in the East End of London while he's on shore leave.
I mean, he goes into the whole history of bipedalism and how the human being got up on its hind legs and walked, and what a huge difference this has made to humanity and culture and our way of living. I mean, my big toes by now are completely horrible, so I didn't like to be made to think about them too much. They're really truly hideous now. But he does say we must look at our big toes bravely and learn to confront them.
I I don't know, but this is probably a terrible thing to say, but I think some of the sort of pressure goes out of the poem in those last couple of books. I'm sort of not so interested in all the firing the arrows through the axe heads and the sort of slaughtering the suitors. Don't know what you feel, Lucy, because you're a classicist, and like, it seems to slightly lose its way there.
Actually, the bit with the dog is very moving. When he just arrives,
terribly moving.
That's very moving, and then you're right, things have to be settled. But actually, I think also all the business with the maids and the killing them and things.
Oh, God.
Yeah, reminds you that he's a warrior. He's not a lovely guy.
Oh, no. It's awful, isn't it? That bit is so Puritan, isn't it? just because they're having a bit of fun with the suitors, they get hanged.
And you're right, that the Penelope thing, there has to be a mechanism by which they have to get back together. So it's a brilliant way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the bed is absolutely lovely, the olive tree.
Yeah.
Very moving and tender. But by that point, he's already killed so many people.
And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS. And that's print and digital. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Later on, we'll be picking through the book, a long-listed book, Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. But first, to the queen of crime and mystery, Agatha Christie, who in her prime was rarely out of the bestseller list. As of 2018, Guinness World Records listed Christie as the best-selling fiction writer of all time, and her novels have now sold more than 2 billion copies in 44 languages. So what is the secret to Christie's continued appeal, and how have her stories remained relevant? Agatha Christie's biographer Laura Thompson joined us to share her theory.
It's reality versus truth, I suppose. You know, her villages are a very good example. They are an artistic construct. But I grew up in a village, and there's a lot of it that rings true to me. And also the village is the brilliant thread whereby she does trace change, because the village is her kind of default setting, if you like, because it's a microcosm of human nature, which is completely true, I think. Really, I do.
Well, before we head into the village, because, I mean, as you say, that's a really, really rich area to explore. You start your essay, and this is how we know we're going to be following a different and a very interesting line from the get-go. You start your essay with her novel from 1965, Bertram's Hotel. So we sort of start in the foyer of Bertram's Hotel. Now, you say it's not one of the classic Christie novels. So tell us what attracts you to this one. How does it help you kind of expound your thesis?
Well, I suddenly thought, oh my God, this is genius. This is genius. This is her, I'm not saying she's doing this deliberately, part of the beauty of her is that although she is so structured and so, controlled as a writer, you do always get the feeling that there's something instinctive about it. And I think with Bertram's Hotel, kind of the same thing. It starts almost like it's 1965 and Harold Wilson is Prime Minister, but who cares? Let's all go and have cucumber sandwiches in this wonderful hotel, which is like this dream of Edwardian England. Miss Marple has gone back there in a spirit of à la recherche She's gone back. She used to go there as a girl. They're all the same things that happened to Agatha herself. She used to go to the Army and Navy, and she'd go to a matinee in a four-wheeler with a pound of coffee creams. That's all what Agatha did. So she's putting her memories into Miss Marple, and she's gone back to this glorious hotel in a side street in Mayfair. It's kind of, people say, Fleming's, where the world has stopped. The clock has stopped. And the lounge is full of minor aristocracy and archdeacons and blah, blah, blah. And they're all being served tea in a way that recreates the glories, to Agatha, of the days when you had servants. And they had a status of their own. It was a hierarchy in which everyone had a real respect and status. That's how she saw it. And, of course, the whole thing is virtual reality. Bertram's Hotel is a crime ring. It's a front for a crime. I'm sorry, I'm giving away an ending here. I'm not giving away the whole thing.
Spoiler from 1965.
Yeah, sorry. But it's not giving away who did the murder, so I'm going to get out of it like that. But the whole thing is a construct. You think you're back in the days of the Golden Age detective story. And, oh, isn't that lovely and all that. She's playing a kind of giant joke on the reader, whereby she says, my God, did you really think this? When I say, oh, how marvellous to be here, not a bit of plastic in the place, and a real chambermaid. The real chambermaid's an out-of-work actress. And half the archdeacons and what have you are criminals dressed up for the part. It's such a coup, I think. And it kind of says, it's 1965, I'm 75 years old, and I have moved with the times more than you give me credit for.
It feels a bit like if let's say, an American postmodernist writer had done that in 1965, it would have been hailed as a brilliant, do you know what I mean, a brilliant fourth wall-breaking revolutionary move. But as you say, it's almost as though she was hiding in plain sight and nobody noticed this very audacious thing.
That's... exactly. Then that's a brilliant. I wish I'd written that. That's absolutely brilliant. And I think completely true. And she's, even when her reputation was low, which was kind of the last quarter of the 20th century, and I started researching it in 2003, and people sort of was still pretty snooty about her. She always had a following among French intellectuals. And you could kind of understand that, because there is this subtext says that the real murderer is somebody else. She's writing on that two-level thing. But I still think you would have to give her credit for creating these things that are... they have an enduring value, which is why she's still up and running in a way that people like other Golden Age writers are not.
Well, I mean, in a way, you were sort of alluding to it there, the simplicity of her books. It's kind of both the problem and the success of them, isn't it? It's for better and for worse.
Yes, I really do think that. Look, I'm a fan, you know.
You don't say.
You know, I've been a fan since I was 10 or whatever. And it's, I did always think, you know, reading them, age 10 or whatever, there's a mesmeric quality to them. You know, there's a kind of, you know, my brother and I used to recite that gramophone record from And Then They Were None at each other, which is ridiculous in one way, but in another way is a tribute to the kind of incantatory power of her incredibly simple style. But of course, you can easily say simplistic.
Well, it's quite hard to imagine an author for whom it's more true that one person can look at it and see a negative, while another person looks at the exact same thing and sees a positive. I mean, I'm thinking of, we don't think of Agatha Christie as being a detailed person so much. There's a lot of sketching and skimming, you know, and some people will see this as just, you know, further evidence that she's just not that good. You know, she's a bit of a hack. Whereas you turn it so that, in fact, this is a very conscious choice, and the notebooks support this. based on her deep understanding of human psychology.
She's you know, even her publisher, Alan Lane, said, how the hell does she do it? You know, we really don't know. She herself couldn't explain how she wrote the books, and yet her writing notebooks are, yes, they are assiduous in working out the plot, but even they sort of work out the plot in almost scenic fashion. She was, although I don't rate her plays at all, she was an absolute theatre nut from a very young age. And I think there is a kind of scenic, you know, it must be very frustrating to people who adapt them, because actually you could just put them straight on the screen and I think they would work incredibly well, because that is how naturally she wrote, I think.
I was just going to say that in terms of the spareness of it, and in a way the output, the only person I can think of who was even faintly comparable is Simenon.
Yes, and even more productive. Yes,
who's also beloved by French intellectuals.
Intellectuals love crime fiction, just full stop. Yeah. Really, don't they?
Oh, do they? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a real thing. I don't know why. Perhaps the genre seems to be, and Lucy, correct me if I'm wrong, but the genre seems to be much more, not so much appreciated, but elevated than it is here. Here, it's kind of like, oh well, it's genre fiction, that kind of slightly outdated term that people like to use disparagingly. Whereas in France, that's never really been the case.
No, there's a lot of respect for them, and I don't think there's no shame, I think, to be seen reading them. And obviously, there's just some, and there still are right now, that are just very, very good. And also, probably, and this is being flippant, but if you're a French intellectual, you probably would like a bit of plot, wouldn't you? After a bit? some stuff happening, maybe.
Something to hold on to.
Yeah,
that's very funny.
Can I ask you a question about Endless Night from 1967? Because you mentioned that, and it seems I haven't read it, and it's not one that I recall hearing very much about. It seems you call it a last classic, but it seems sort of like an outlier in the oeuvre in some ways. What do you think she's sort of setting out to do in that one?
Endless Night is a first person narrative, and it's a young man. He's sexy. She says working class. He's got nothing. He's got no money. He's just got a huge amount of sex appeal and a kind of ambition that is nebulous but overweening. And she writes this book from his point of view, his desire to get something out of life without really earning it, which is, I suppose, by her standards, growing up in this kind of Christian late Victorian, is a sensibility that is inimical to her. But she inhabits it absolutely brilliantly, and it does feel a very fresh contemporary book now. You know, that culture of, well, if you like, the kind of celebrity culture or something for nothing or whatever. She's not condemnatory at all. She's very non-judgmental as a writer. I do find that, despite her stern moral code. That sounds like a contradiction, but I feel both those things. And she just inhabits this young man in a first-person narration. And she, to my mind, there's very few false notes in it. She writes about him thinking about sex. It's kind of comes easily. And she said, you know, people were amazed that I'd done it. Well, I didn't find it difficult at all. I listened to people and I just sort of did it. I don't know how disingenuous that is. But it is an outlier. It's a kind of character study, but I think very, very successful. And probably one of her best books, actually.
Yes, I'm going to read that one. It sounds incredible.
Please let me know what you think. I do absolutely get, well, yeah, because sometimes, I mean, I've read them so many times, it's ridiculous. And they've got me through, you know, feeling ill and bereavement and all sorts of things. But, you know, sometimes I read them and I think, oh, come on, this is just flat, plain, clever, but what? Why are you? And then another time I'll read them and just the feeling of the end coming. It's a little bit like, I say in the book, adult fairy tales, you know, that beautiful sense of resolution that you get when you're a kid and you read a fairy tale. that there is a sort of magic about that on some fundamental, you know, just the beauty of narrative that we all feel, that she reduces to very, very simple elements. And there is something quite exciting about that. But again, you know, I don't want to say that she's better than Muriel Spark or whatever. And in one way, it is pure genre, and she never strays outside the genre in the way that other, you know, P.D. James writes these kind of Dickensian, weighty sort of... She is pure genre, which is what fascinates me all the more, because all the mystery of why she is so enduring and fascinating is within and hidden. I can't think of anyone quite like her, although you say Simenon, that's interesting. That's an interesting comparison, I think. But she is certainly unlike any other detective of her contemporaries, for example. She couldn't be more unlike, really, I don't think.
Laura Thompson talking to us there about the life and works of Agatha Christie. Now, we heard earlier on from last year's winner of the Booker Prize, but now to a book that is a contender this time around. Clara and the Sun is the latest novel from the Nobel Prize winner Kazuo Ishiguro. Our critic Edmund Gordon read it and talked us through it in as spoiler-free a manner as possible.
I will certainly try to do that, but it's a very difficult novel to discuss without spoilers, because more and more of the world is revealed as it progresses. It's narrated by a robot who begins called Clara, who begins the story unsold in a shop and understands basically nothing about the world she lives in. And she's subsequently purchased by a 14-year-old girl called Josie and taken home with her. And she starts to piece together how her world works. And it's only as she does that we are able to understand anything about it. So if I say anything more than I've already said, which I will, I'll say a little bit more, but I'm already putting the listener in a different position when they come to the novel than I was in when I read it. So switch off now if you don't want to hear anything. But I shouldn't say that. But she gradually comes to understand that robots like her, I mean, it's set in the near future in what seems to be America, and that advances in automation and artificial intelligence have led to a complete restructuring of society, basically, and especially a restructuring of the world of work and most members of what are referred to in the novel as the former professional classes have been made redundant and have sort of left the cities where they lived and moved to these kind of alternative communities. And in addition to that, children, certainly sort of privileged children, such as Josie, are what's called lifted in the novel, which means genetically edited, genetically manipulated, to give them some chance of obtaining one of the few remaining jobs. And there are various other twists and revelations as it progresses, which I won't reveal. But even what I've said already sort of only comes into focus quite slowly as you're reading.
You say in your review that it is sometimes hard to form certainly a clear picture of what's happening, even in quite a literal way, because the story is narrated very much from Clara's point of view. So you literally see how she sees, because the way that she, well, you can explain how she visualizes things.
Yeah, well, there's lots of odd sort of optical effects almost in the novel where Clara, I think even when her vision, it's not 100% clear, I have to say, but I think that even when her vision is operating as it usually does, she visualizes things in quite a different way to us. So, for example, she seems completely unable to distinguish between different specimens of the same type. So if she encounters two sets of red shelves or two of the same brand of machine, she will think that they are literally the same one as one another. But then sometimes, and this seems to be to do with a sort of processing error, it seems to be at moments of heightened emotional activity, her vision kind of fragments and breaks up into a series of separate panels or boxes, which don't, I described it in the piece as being like a poorly assembled jigsaw puzzle. So you'll have different parts of the picture which sort of belong together spread across her visual plane.
You know, when you you have to sign into something and you have to do I'm not a robot and yes. you have the boxes with different things in, that's what it made me think of.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like that, except there the boxes do form a coherent picture. They haven't been scrambled. They're just kind of separated from one another, aren't they? I can't quite visualize one of those. But yeah, maybe that's where he took it from. But it does mean that you're sort of the mental track that you have of what's going on is sometimes quite fuzzy. And beyond that, I think there are things that Clara doesn't understand that therefore we can't really understand, that are just sort of permanently obscure to us. You know, there are scenes that she sees that she doesn't know how to interpret or that she obviously misinterprets. And there's no key available, I think, to us to sort of work out what's really going on behind that.
Yes, which I quite like, because it's not spelled out for you. You've really just got to think about it, and it's not always clear. But it does seem surprising, because on one hand, she's a very, very sophisticated, like extremely sophisticated AI. And on the other hand, you think, well, there's a lot about the world that she doesn't know, but maybe then the idea is that they've done that on purpose, because she's supposed to be a companion for a child, isn't she? And there is a kind of childlike element to the whole thing. I read that Ishiguro said it originally started as a story for his daughter when she was young, and he showed it to his wife, and his wife said, there's no way you are publishing that as a children's book. It's far too bleak.
I read that as well. And I suppose there is a kind of, I mean, the mood of the novel is quite optimistic, basically, I think, in spite of the darkness of the world. And I suppose that might be what's been carried over from that original iteration. But yeah, it doesn't seem like a children's book to me.
Now, when you say that Clara has got a more distant perspective, but did you not feel that she becomes more engaged and learns more? We're told often that she's a particularly perceptive AI, that she's particularly good at that.
Yeah, we're told that often, but that seems to me like a sort of misdirection or signposting that we're supposed to start wondering whether she is, because she certainly gets a lot of stuff wrong about what's happening. And she often, you know, although she will take interest in a given subject or relationship between people, she'll kind of get the wrong end of the stick about it. So I think she's certainly curious. That's a word that I would apply to her. But I think whether she's observant or perceptive. I mean, observant, I don't know if it's deliberate that there's that word used about her when we know from her own descriptions that her optical field is sort of all over the place. She often is completely incapable of observing things in a reliable manner.
And so there's various ways that we think about the AI. She's called an AF, an artificial friend, isn't she? But let's say I'm in a humanless future and I'm an AI and I'm reading this for reference to find out about humans. I'm fine with the AI stuff. I've got that. How do you think I would think about the humans in it?
I mean, I think that the human characters, there's a lot of love in this novel. Most of them are acting out of love for other characters within the novel. Sometimes Clara sort of sees them all as lonely, but again, I'm not sure that we're supposed to take that as literal. I think that they have hope and that they sort of power themselves with their hope for the future, and quite often that comes to nothing. But I think that they're on, certainly the main characters, there are sort of four central human characters, and I think that they're all likeable characters. There are some less likeable figures in the background.
I have to say, though, speaking as an AI against the humans, they make some pretty questionable decisions, and also there is the question of how Clara is treated.
I mean, towards the end of the novel, and I it's hard to discuss this without spoilers, but certainly their treatment of her does seem slightly callous, and yet it is hard to tell the extent to which she is intended to be a, you know, sort of character fully equipped with emotional responses.
But there's a point in the book when she says, isn't she, I think I have feelings.
Yeah.
I'm having feelings about this.
Yeah, there is, absolutely. I mean, I don't know, maybe this is just human chauvinism on my part, but I certainly found the relations between the human characters much more moving than I did Clara's own trajectory during it. And I more or less viewed her as a kind of a window onto the human characters.
Yes, and even the people that you worry about, which again, it seemed to be clearly signposted that some terrible stuff might happen to them. There's a couple of them actually in different situations. The sort of human ingenuity and hope, I suppose, finds a way through, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a, you know, the overall tone of the novel is one of kind of optimism and tenderness and love, I think.
I was going to ask you about that because reading about him again, he said he's often been surprised at the reception of his books because he didn't think that Never Let Me Go was very bleak. He was very surprised when everyone said, oh my gosh. You know, he's like, oh, I thought that one was pretty nice and tender.
It was supposed to be another child's book, presumably.
Imagine.
Is he trolling us? I just don't know. I mean, he's... Yeah, it didn't seem to me like a cheery story, Never Let Me Go. This does seem to me, I don't know, cheerier in tone at least, if not in kind of content all the time. But, I mean, it's hard to know when writers talk about their books, it's hard to know the extent to which we should take them seriously sometimes.
Excellent general rules going
out
there.
I think we should just not.
But it's the case for most people that their books are cleverer than they are. So I think we shouldn't necessarily listen to an author's what they have to say about how their book should be interpreted.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the TLS podcast produced by Ben Mitchell, looking back at the past year on this show. We'll be back in September with a return to regular programming. But in the meantime, issues of the TLS continue to appear every week and our summer double issue towards the end of this month looks set to be quite something. So why not look into a print and digital subscription? You'll find a special subscription offer just for podcast listeners in this episode's description. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye and see you in September.